All right, today is October 3rd, 2018, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Tim Stidell in Skagway, Alaska for the Klondike Gold Rush Historical Park Oral History Project. And we are also accompanied by Susanna Dowds, who's listening in, who's working here as a historian. So Tim, thank you for
absolutely
making time today. So just to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Okay, well, I'm the chief ranger here at the park. I oversee the public safety program and the backcountry operations for the Chilkoot Trail. And I have a law enforcement program, trail center operation, backcountry permit office, and oversee just the three units of the park. They're the White Pass, the Chilkoot, and the historic Skagway units. So I've been at the park since I arrived in April of 1994. And at the time I came in as a pretty much a entry level law enforcement ranger. Although I was overseeing the backcountry ranger operation at that time, working for the chief ranger. And I started out in Virginia with the National Park Service, and actually in 1987, although I did a stint in Youth Conservation Corps, YCC, in high school with Prince William Forest Park. When, I think it was 1980.
With which park?
Prince William Forest Park in National Capital Region.
Oh, okay.
And it was in Northern Virginia. And that was in 1985 when I was in high school. So I went through the cooperative education internship program with Virginia Tech and kind of alternated between school and work. Spent one season of that at ST Island National Seashore in Maryland. And then just before they were going to hire me permanent at Prince William Forest Park at the end of my program, when I graduated college, I had applied for an intake training program which brought me to Alaska. So I got that and came to Seward, Kenai Fjords National Park in 1991 in June. And I worked there to finish out my cooperative, or the intake program, until March, April of 94 when I was able to land the position here in Skagway.
So are you originally from Virginia?
I am, yes. I was born and raised in Virginia.
Yeah. Okay.
So I met my wife when I was at Kenai Fjords National Park, and she was actually working for the Alaska Natural History Association, which is now Alaska Geographic, and she had come down at one Christmas to winter caretake at the glacier cabin out at Exit Glacier there in the park. And by the time I came to move to Skagway, I proposed to her, and she came back in October of that year, and we got married, and actually went back to Seward to get married, but she then moved over to Skagway with me after that.
So, great. So can you tell me a little bit about this program that you were talking about, and the co-op program and the intake program, what that is?
Yeah, today it's called Pathways. Back at the time when I was in college, it was the cooperative education program, and it's kind of like a student internship where you have an opportunity to do enter into an agreement between the school and the agency, a park of, I guess, the employee's choice that is able to find a park willing to enter into a relationship like that. And since I had this prior Youth Conservation Corps summer that I worked with the park, there was a chief ranger there who remembered me, and he was predisposed then to kind of put a good word in, and the park had an opening and an opportunity to enter into an agreement like that with the Virginia Tech. So it was about a six-quarter program, and you alternate part-time, about half-time in school, half-time in work. And then when I graduated from that, as I recall, the intake program, because I was still part of that cooperative ed program, you have different types of hiring authorities that you can be brought into the intake program, and that was the cooperative ed program was one of them. So much like the Pathways, it made me eligible for permanent hire, and then the intake program was able to pick me up. The intake program is a upward mobility type of training program in the Park Service that's about every 3 to 5 years, it seems like, over the years, it would get congressional budget support to have it, and then it would get cut for a few years. So it would run 3 years. It's been reduced to one or two years now. And you get assigned to a park. In my case, they were trying to create diversity so that people would have different experiences. So if I came from the D.C. area, so they wanted to move you to a more rural area. If you were, in some cases in my class, we had people who were at Yellowstone working seasonally, and they qualified for the program, but they moved them to Washington, D.C. Worked out a lot better in my situation. Some of those that went to the big cities weren't quite as happy about it. The idea is that within your three-year term, at least once, maybe a couple of times, you'll move. That year, nobody moved until their last year, so it was kind of hard for some people. But I loved it. I loved working in Seward and Kenai Fjords. I loved Alaska. Yeah. As soon as I got off the plane, I just called my mom and I got to Seward and said, "I'm not coming home, Mom." That was our two-year plan, three-year plan maybe. I spent the whole 3 years pretty much at Kenai Fjords in Seward. And at the end of the program, they try to get you placed within the region, ideally. The region's supposed to reserve a spot somewhere. So it turned out Klondike had one, and it was real similar to Seward and as far as community and coastal park environment. And it was a good fit for me. I think everybody was just going to kind of figure it was a two-year stint, see how it went, and I ended up being here the whole time. So,
that's great. Yeah. Well, so when you were starting out and in college, were you planning to go into law enforcement in a park type setting, actually, or what inspired you to do that?
Right, I actually wasn't. I was in working at college. I was in the School of Forestry, and my background was a wildland recreation. So I was interested in the parks. I always was. I actually, from my earliest memories, wanted to be a park ranger, and I wasn't necessarily sure what all that meant between a Forest Service and a ranger park ranger. Right. But as I got closer to college, in high school, I had a really good English teacher. I actually had us do what she called an iSearch project, and it was a research project preparing yourself for the college or career of choice that you want to go into, and identify schools in your area of study that you're interested in, what the requirements were, high school requirements for classes to be able to be eligible to get in, and what testing requirements. So it really prepared me well so that when I got to my college and learned about the programs like the cooperative ed program, there's only a handful of us that really knew what they were about and signed up for them. A lot of students, unfortunately, just didn't know about them. Mm-hmm. And I think they all ended up a little bit behind the curve when it came to landing jobs outside of college. So
your college degree is in forestry, wildland recreation?
It is, yeah. I kind of did a, not really a major, but they had specialty areas in the School of Forestry, the Virginia Tech, and wildland recreation was my specialty. But I also did the silviculture side for forest timber harvesting operations. So I kind of had both that way. I went an extra year, actually, to get that accomplished. And then my experience at Prince William Forest Park for all those seasons, really. I was a natural resource management, actually, and I really enjoyed that, predisposed with my area of study to pursue a career in natural resources. And it wasn't until I got into the intake program that they didn't really have a natural resource specialist position, but they had a generalist ranger. And I actually spent most of my first year at Kenai Fjords in interpretation. And it was at the end of that we had an opportunity. One of the benefits of that program is funded out of the Washington office, so the park didn't have to front all the costs for the training and development, and you're supposed to spend about half your time in development and training. So I started shifting it toward a more generalist ranger stint, and it's a little easier to go to FLETC in those days and get your law enforcement commission, whether you were
FLETC
is the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center.
Okay.
So whether you were in natural resource management, interpretation, even the superintendent in some parks had their law enforcement commission, and I got it on my what would have been my individual development plan in those days, and got it approved for funding, and they sent me to FLETC and let me get my law enforcement commission. And the park at that time didn't have any law enforcement rangers below the chief ranger, so it was good timing to step in and fill in a need that was there, and that just kind of set me up to continue on down the road more in the law enforcement emergency services arena. Yeah.
Okay, and so you came here to Klondike Park in April of 1994, you said?
And that's right, April of 1994, I arrived in Skagway.
And so what were you doing? You said you were just sort of a general ranger.
I was a general ranger.
What does that mean?
But I was a generalist ranger. Yeah, today it's very different. Back in the day, the 025 generalist ranger really worked in a lot of different areas. You could be hired as a resource person, but also still do interpretation and maybe still do some law enforcement. We weren't really specialized in law enforcement in those days. We did have positions that were specialized, but a lot of your generalist rangers had commissions, but they didn't do, you know, more than 50% of their job in law enforcement. In those days, we used to, you know, keep our firearms in our locker, and only on rare occasions something was happening and unfolding, and we'd go to our locker and throw our gear on and call in the service and go. You see less and less of that these days.
Yeah.
So we become, with Ranger Careers and Ranger Futures, we became a lot more specialized in law enforcement. And a lot of those generalist positions have really disappeared in the lower 48, and they're starting to disappear in Alaska. We were kind of the last holdout, stronghold for generalist kind of rangers. You'll see the difference between my generation and these new generation rangers coming in, where I always describe it to people. I was a ranger first and got my law enforcement. Today, they're law enforcement first and decide parks are a neat, nice environment to go work in, so they come out and become rangers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small difference, but those who've been around can see the difference in priorities and the nature of the work that the rangers kind of are drawn to.
Yeah, and nowadays there's interpretive specialists,
right,
and managers and rangers, and it seems very specialized.
It's true. Yeah, they all have specialized now, and it's professionalized in a lot of ways. But because we haven't, as an agency, in my feeling, expanded in depth and scope to meet the needs of all the park job requirements in all those areas, because we specialize now, we don't have enough resources, money, and support to actually properly staff all of those in specialized functions. And law enforcement here is really struggling with that.
Oh,
because,
really?
It's just hard to keep up with all the requirements, whether, you know, we're saying we're not generalists anymore, we're specialized, but we're doing aircraft aviation management and safety, we're doing fee collection, we're still doing structural fire management and wildland fire response, we're still doing permits management, commercial operations. So all of a sudden now we're supposed to be specializing in law enforcement, but we still have to make sure all these other things are getting done. So it's been a challenge in Alaska, and I think across all the parks, to be able to still fulfill all those roles but still work in a specialized or professional world that we're in today. So.
Yeah. Well, and I would think that each park has different needs. You know, as you say, a park in Washington, D.C.,
right,
or Yosemite versus,
right,
Skagway,
right,
have different needs, both in terms of law enforcement and all the other positions.
Absolutely, yeah.
And if they're trying to make it generic across the board, that,
right,
might be difficult.
Right, right. And it's very difficult to do, but the parks are so varied and diverse across the nation. We don't fit a cookie cutter model for across the agency, but I think we do a pretty good job as best we can, but
yeah.
It does make for some challenges.
Yeah. So when you first got here, you know, what kind of things did you work on?
So when I first got here, I was the only permanent law enforcement ranger working below the chief ranger. And the superintendent was actually commissioned in those days too. So both of them were, while they were in senior management, they could carry a gun and back up and respond. Superintendent never did that, but the
and
chief ranger.
Who were they at
occasions.
The time? Who was that?
At that time, Clay Alderson was superintendent, and Bruce Reed was the first chief ranger when I got here for a couple of years before he moved on. I think he retired here. I believe he did, and then left. So I was the only permanent chief ranger or law enforcement ranger. I wasn't chief. I was an entry-level ranger at that time. And I had a couple of seasonal law enforcement rangers. At one time, three law enforcement seasonal rangers on the Choku Trail. So we actually commissioned all of our backcountry trail seasonals in those days, which we don't today.
Oh.
Because of a lot of that's because of that specialization and all the required training and travel and background, all the required elements that go into maintaining a full-time permanent commission has just got really expensive. Took much of the year to get it, and for seasonals it just was getting harder to work out. They do still have some in the region, but it's a tough program to manage, and especially in a highly politically volatile community where you want some stability and continuity, where the people know and build a trust and relationship with the LA Rangers. The seasonals, it just took one coming in and having a contact go bad. And when I say bad, meaning that they just were doing their job, but the local community doesn't like their job. Right. Right. If they didn't have the years of experience to kind of know when to push things hard and when to soft pedal things, it could lead to a setback in the community with the park and the community relationship 10 years mm-hmm. real fast. But I was more of a field ranger, but I was overseeing the backcountry ranger operation and supervised the trail rangers. We didn't have the trail center in those days. But I was out in the field a lot more. We actually did the Dai walking tours in those days. For about 4 or 5 years, the Rangers did those tours around the Dai town site. So I was actually out there a couple times a week doing those as well. But.
And then did you hike up and down the trail?
Yeah, more than I do now. I was probably up there 4 or 5 times a summer. Not many, but occasionally I'd actually cover a full shift because a ranger would get sick or hurt and we'd have a vacancy there. I was definitely out in the field a lot more then.
And what types of things do you encounter when you're out there in the field?
Mostly on the trail. I mean, we had a lot of, pretty quickly, 94 wasn't too bad. By 1995, we had a lot of bear incidents starting to rise. We had a number of cubs, twins being born in 94. And when we saw that, we had a geologist up here, Greg Strebler from Gustavus, came to visit and talk to us, and when he heard that we were having several sets of twins being born, he said it's usually indicative of a population explosion and an increase, and sure enough we did. And we weren't as prepared for it in those days because we didn't have a lot of bear activity in the parks prior to that. And all of a sudden we had an increase in people hiking the trail too, and a combination of bears increasing and people increasing and not good education. We didn't have the trail center, so only about half of the hikers were being contacted before they get on the trail. We had a kind of a honor system, permit system. And so we had a lot of people doing crazy things out there, putting peanut butter jars on the picnic table, trying to get pictures of the bears coming up in the canal jar. We had reports of people petting the bear for pictures. So pretty soon, I think the first encounter that really sticks out in my mind is that Canyon City suspension bridge going across to the town site. And we didn't have any bear poles or bear facilities there at that time. And people would drop their packs to go across onto the spur trail off to kind of a tangent trail to the main trail, and they dropped their packs so they didn't have to carry them for the extra 20 minutes to go in there and back out, and came back and found that a bear had broken into their pack and gotten to their canned oysters. And apparently they were good canned oysters, and the bears must have loved them, because he was a problem the rest of the summer for us. We really had to learn what it meant to do bear hazing, and we really started beefing up our interpretive information and education program and trying to get information out ahead of time. But so a lot of time spent with bears and people with education. But we saw a lot less of a prepared hiker in those days without the trail center. People were bringing suitcases up the trail, like hard-sided luggage suitcases to go over the trail.
Were they trying to recreate the
No, I didn't get that sense. They just really were not prepared and didn't have any idea of what hiking remote Alaska mountains would be like. So we had a couple, I'll just tell you this one. I had a ranger who worked for me, Nancy Shea, when I first got here. At that time, she was probably in her late 40s. And she was up at sheep camp at near mile 13, and had these two young children, probably around the ages of 10, 12 years old, show up at the porch of the ranger station at the end of the day. Wet, cold, and very hungry, no backpacks, little day packs, and they'd been each given a hot dog, and the grandfather dropped them off at the trailhead and said, I'll meet you on the other side at a log cabin where they would hike through and get picked up if you're doing the whole trail. Well, he thought it was a day hike, and that's how much preparation they'd done. And they got to 13 miles at Sheep Camp and got Nancy put them up for the night, fed them, and didn't send them the rest of the way over the trail, and brought them back out when she came off the trail to reunite with the grandfather. But that's the level of preparation that people were showing up with on the, at the trailhead.
So explain what the trail center is. And people now need permits, and they didn't need permits back then.
It was a kind of volunteer honorary permit. We wanted them to have permits, but we couldn't enforce it because we didn't have any way to meet the hikers. It was about 50-50 whether a Dyea Ranger ran into them at the trailhead or whether somebody, a ranger on the trail, even passed them, or if they were passing too early or late, they didn't see them. So it was about 1996 that we actually had Kathy Cook was the chief of interpretation here, and she's the one actually who had the vision and came to me and said, you know, Tim, what you need to do is open up a backcountry station and issue permits and have a desk and have rangers assigned that can meet people and have everybody required to come through for an orientation and get a permit. So we started putting some ideas together, started working with Parks Canada, who's been partners with the International Park for years at this point, but and on the trail. But it was about the right time because they were wanting to charge a fee. They wanted us to charge a fee at the same time, but we didn't have the right political climate at the time to go into fees, and we didn't have the fee revenue legislation we have now with FLRIA, Federal Lands Recreation Enhancement Act, I think. So that's what gave us our instrument a little bit later. But at this time, Parks Canada was kind of ready to enter into something like a trail center operation. We were starting to get more and more interest. We actually had the little blue building across the street here, the Itchin House, was our first trail center. That had just opened up. It had been a supervisor's office for the restoration crew that were working on the Pantheon, Moore House projects, Penile Mission. Mm-hmm. All of those had recently been restored, and that was the supervisor's office. So that all finished. It opened up. They were deciding whether to put it into the lease program. It was kind of an awkward building. They recognized that. May not have made the most economic sense for somebody to take that for their shop where they want to sell jewelry or produce product, and you have these little windows that people can't see through hardly, and you know, it just wasn't the most well designed. It was somebody's home, right, with a unique personality. It wasn't intended to be a storefront. So the park decided that, yeah, we have this need, it makes sense, we got two agencies that can come together and more economically manage and staff this office and take care of both our needs. So by 97, I can't remember for sure if it was 96 or 97 when we first opened it, but I know by 97 we would have had it in operation. And the first year, I know we didn't charge a fee. I'm thinking Parks Canada didn't start charging their fee until 98. That was the big centennial. But they put two people of theirs in the trail center at that time, and we put one. So we had three. What we can now call visitor service assistants. They would have probably just been generalist park rangers in that day, GS4s, even 3s maybe for a while. And they were in there to give orientations and prepare hikers about what to expect, safety concerns, bear, avalanche safety, permit conditions, backcountry policies. It was real important. We had to emphasize differences between Canada and the U.S. and our different policies. We have dish water pits on our side because our ground table's not quite, or our
groundwater.
I mean, I'm sorry. We started out trying to do some dishwater pits. They failed because our groundwater is too high. We actually have, they have dishwater pits on their side because they don't have the groundwater issues. But we have a good flowing river that will wash, you know, as long as the gray waterway, as long as they strain out their particulates, mm-hmm, of their food and the solids. But in Canada, if they do that, it goes into the lakes and sits there, and it becomes, you know, fungal blooms and things, right, and it becomes a real impact. So we have those kinds of differences. We need to educate the users because you're going to do this on our side, but it's going to be very different. You get to the Canadian side. Similarly, subsistence uses were very different. They have, even though we're in Alaska where there's a lot of subsistence regulations and allowances, we're not a subsistence park here at Klondike Gold Rush. So a lot of subsistence uses you can maybe do in Denali and Wrangell St. Elias and Lake Clark. You can't do them here in Skagway and Klondike Gold Rush. On the Canadian side, however, while they don't have Alaska subsistence per se, they have similar laws and allowances for their First Nations people. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they have more restrictions on hunting and fishing for others who aren't First Nations people, whereas we have, because of our agreement with the state of Alaska, since we don't own much of the land on the Chilkoot Trail, The state actually does, and now more private and municipal land in ownership, we actually are required under that agreement to manage the land to allow hunting and fishing was legal anyhow, right. But hunting is legal on non-federal lands within the park unit, which is for lower 48, that's you have them, but it's not normal. So,
most national parks, there's no hunting other than subsistence.
Right, right.
So I didn't realize that here that there was that mix with state
and federal. Right, all because of that agreement in order for us to manage land that's not our own, but it's in the park. So, yeah. Yeah, and it gets pretty convoluted. It's only state land within 300 feet of the corridor of the trail. So it's not even all the land that's in the park. That's not ours. Right. So it really is kind of a law enforcement nightmare for our new rangers to try to learn all this and figure out. It's really one of the things I emphasize with them. Know where your feet is, where you're standing, because it's very different if you're here versus over here as far as how you can enforce or if you even can enforce the law. So
once you got the trail center set up, how did you start educating the public? I mean, now everybody knows you got to get a permit.
But
they didn't back then.
Yeah, it actually worked out pretty well because we found that most people wanted to come in and get good information. Yeah, it was a bit of a learning period for a year or two there where we definitely had some people we missed that got on the trail that hadn't gotten their permits. And we still occasionally have that happen. But it went really pretty well. We realized when we joined up with Parks Canada that we wanted to streamline the process so that for the user, they weren't duplicating everything. We don't want you to have to go through a orientation with the U.S. and then get an orientation with Parks Canada, and go through and get their permit, and then come and get our Canada permit, pay a U.S. fee, and then pay a Canadian fee. I mean, we wanted to not cause that kind of grief for the hikers. So we really came up with a joint permit process, one orientation program, and the fee is all included together, collected initially by Parks Canada, and then they remit back to us at the end of the year, a couple times during the year, our portion of it. So for the user, it's really pretty much a one-stop kind of operation, mm-hmm. but it doesn't come without its management challenges to make all of that happen with the currency exchanges and things like that. But it went pretty well considering you're working with an international entity, having some of their employees live in the U.S. for part of the year and exchanging funds across the border. And when we approached Washington, basically the word is if we can come up with something that's working for you, don't involve us because we'll probably shut it down. We have a letter of concurrence. We can't call it a MOU or an agreement because that would become an international treaty, which we're not allowed to enter into. So we have a kind of informal letter of concurrence that each agency agrees to of this is what we're going to provide. This is our expectation. And we provided the building over there, one employee working in the trail center, pretty much utilities included. And Parks Canada provided a 1-800 reservation line and somebody in Whitehorse to work that, two employees in the trail center, and the Camas, which is a big one, the Camas reservation system, which is their Canadian, started out as a hotel reservation system, and they tried to make it adapted to backcountry camp setting, which was a little weird. Camas has not always been a real user-friendly system that way, but it worked, and each year we keep getting it to work better as we work with the software programmers to.
Well, I know Parks Canada has a whole reservation system for campgrounds.
Right.
Because I've used it for their eastern parks.
Okay. Kind of real similar to the ones we have in our national fee program.
Yeah.
I don't know how much pressure they get to go to that. I know we get pressure sometimes to think about it for our side of the operation, but because it's all managed and self-contained by Parks Canada, and then we just get checks from them, there's no pressure to us to say, you have to do it. But I wouldn't be surprised if someday Bars Canada follows similar suit and makes them go to their national program. Yeah. But
well, it's interesting. I didn't realize that so much was done with Parks Canada. You know, I think of, oh, you come hike the trail, you're at Skagway, and you go through the U.S. Park Service, and I didn't realize they had such a role in it. I mean, I knew they managed part of the trail, but I figured the whole permitting, because don't most hikers start on the Skagway Dyea end?
They do. Yeah, it's just that, and part of why that evolved that way is because they were ready to charge a fee and we weren't. So they had the motivation to get that reservation system, make sure it worked for the money side of things. And then finally, it was quite a few years later when Floria was passed. I can't exactly remember the year that was. It's probably somewhere early 2004, somewhere in that time frame. We finally decided to look at what areas can we meet the conditions of the law, and they were motivating us to try to find ways to charge fees. But the Chilkoot Trail was one of those, in the Dyea campground,
right,
for falling under the enhanced recreation fee criteria, and then at that point, CAMIS and the Parks Canada system was well established, and we just had to do some modifications to work our part into it.
So through this whole setting up this permit system, do you limit how many hikers can go on the trail per day?
Yeah, and that's the beauty, again, of our partnership with Parks Canada, is the bottleneck happens at the Chilkoot Pass, and Happy Camp is our smallest campground in Canada, just on the other side of the pass there, several miles. We've always had a higher capacity at Sheep Camp, even though it wasn't always the best campground design there. We've gone through a few of them over the years, and avalanches and floods and everything else to get us to where we are today with our campground. But we could always accommodate somewhere around 80 campers if we needed to, whereas Happy Camp was always 50 was a pretty big max for them, and they even had to do some improvements to get to that. So we kind of had Tom, and there was a Parks Canada employee who'd come back from college, and limits of acceptable change and use capacities was his field of study. And he did some science research and identified 50 as the maximum capacity for hikers coming over the top of the pass and being able to be supported at both Happy Camp and Deep Lake, the next two campgrounds along the trail. So that became our limit, and it worked for us too, because that way we didn't have to worry about exceeding our capacities at all. Mm-hmm. But we weren't going to send 100 people over the pass just because we can accommodate them and then, you know, create a problem for Parks Canada. So in the program, there was a map, and you could actually have red flags pop up when you got to your limit at each campground on both sides of the trail. And it helped us to be able to have those established to really manage the use across the trail. I will say, over the years, we observed, because in those years, for a while, we had trains that ran every day, and it was pretty good, but there were some years where the trains got down to just a few days a week, and you would see these huge spikes of when hikers, of course, would associate their hike and their days on the trail with when they were going to end up at Bennett with the train. And we would get 80 people at Sheep Camp in a night, and which now is too many, but back then it was way too many, but they could all fit into this giant circle, because the design of the time back in at that period was to go out and just clear all the trees out of this area the size of a soccer field, and everybody just set up their tents wherever. It wasn't a real positive experience when we got into 1998. And it would have been much like the Gold Rush, when there was just way too many people all crammed into little places there on the trail.
So why did they create set campgrounds? I mean, most, you know, trails, you just go off the trail, set your tent up wherever. So when did that get set up that way, and why?
Well, you'll notice that the campgrounds are aligned with actual town sites from the Gold Rush. So they're already pre-developed areas, and they were developed there for a reason. It's the only flat, really good, developable places to establish a camp. Mm-hmm. In 1898, they were towns. Today, there are campgrounds, and it's still the same holds true. Plus, everything else was their transportation corridor with all kinds of resources and cultural resources. So the campgrounds themselves have a lot of resources in them, but the whole valley is just filled with cultural resources. So we don't want to develop those areas over those resources that we've decided as a park, especially from that point early on, that there were all the cultural artifacts and remnants would remain in situ on the trail and allowed to kind of naturally slowly degrade. But we're not to create management activities that just wipe them out. So even in the campgrounds, we go out with our archaeologists and we do compliance to make sure that when we identify a place for new campsites, that we're not going to be irreversibly damaging some resources in that area. But they kept the campgrounds and the established developed town sites of the trail, and they decided it's a lot better for the resource, both natural really and cultural, to sacrifice a area for developed camp facilities as opposed to have people constantly going out into different areas, kind of like a wilderness setting where, you know, you're in a small narrow valley, so everyone's going to go off into the same general areas as opposed to wilderness where you disperse your use so that it never really becomes a big impact. You can't do that in this valley, so you just sacrifice the camp areas and do that as minimally intrusive as you can, and then hold them there in a well-developed fashion for mm-hmm. years. So.
Okay. And then as you progressed in your job through the mm-hmm. 90s, you moved up into this chief ranger position in 2006.
I did. I'm one of those rare beasts that outlasted everybody, I guess, and managed to promote up in the same park. It hasn't happened very often. People have to move. Generally, in the Park Service, you move around a lot because if you want to promote, you got to move. But it just, the timing always worked out, and I've been here a long time, and I wasn't one who was motivated to promote all along. I enjoyed the field, enjoyed my job, and wasn't really driven, but everybody, I think, gets to that point where, you know, it's time, and the right time opened up, and there was a reorganization in the park during one of those years where we went through what they called the core budget reduction process. It was one of those that was probably more of a threat of what was going to happen than what actually happened. But we had to go through the process, and they actually did enact some strategies to try to reduce the base operating budgets of the park to prepare. And a part of that was, at the time, the chief ranger, because of some medical issues, was going to have to get out of law enforcement. And there was an opening in chief of admin, and he had a few years left until he was kind of at his retirement date anyhow. So he transitioned over into the chief of admin position and left a vacancy and asked me if I wanted to step up into the chief ranger role. So at that point, I was finally ready to do that. So.
And who was that?
Reed McCluskey.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that was about 2008 when I stepped in to chief ranger, so about 8 years, 10 years now. Yeah. So yeah, it's gone fast.
Yeah. And so how do your duties differ now that you're chief ranger?
Not much more administrative, not out on the trail so much as I used to be. Not as fun, but rewarding in other ways. I've told folks recently, I think the highlight of my career has been able to help other employees get the developmental experiences and opportunities they need to further their careers and to hopefully move on into their dream positions. And I feel like we've been pretty successful for a lot of our rangers at doing that here. And where they may not get a lot of hardcore law enforcement kind of work, they get a lot of opportunity that has made them good rangers, I think, for management and being able to see the big picture and being able to work as a team and work in a lot of different areas. That generalist thing that right. has disappeared, I still think there's a lot of value in it and merit that makes you good in management, whether it's superintendent or in higher level management positions throughout the agency. So I think it's been a good park that way, developmental for people. So, you know, a lot of my job is supervision. I spend a lot. Supervision doesn't get the credit for how much time, if you really want to do it and put the time into it, it takes. Every little bit of counseling, time of discussion about people's development and opportunities, and, you know, so much of my time is just sitting down one-on-one talking with the rangers about different contacts I've made out here in town. And it could have gone this way, but I decided to take it this way, and I think this is why it was better to go this approach. The book says you could do it this way, but I've learned some hard knocks that if you take a little bit of a lighter community policing kind of approach, you can get a lot more compliance with a lot less grief. And those little nuggets I like to share with my employees, and just spending time passing those things on. You know, there's always the disciplinarian side of things that you have to deal with too, and those take a lot of time, and they're a big drain on the program and morale and everything. Yeah. So that's definitely something that doesn't get credit for when we look at our job descriptions of what we do, of how much time is involved in that. Mm-hmm. But no, that's been one of the biggest challenges for me here, especially in the last few years. When A123 came out, that's a new Park Service audit program that every discipline, I think, just about is touched by it. Rangers are hit hard, and admin's getting hit harder. Maintenance is getting hit hard with it. And it's I used to sit around with Reed McCluskey and talk a little bit about regulations and laws versus policy, and how everybody likes to throw out, well, this is required by law. Well, most of the time what they're really looking at is required by either a policy or maybe a safety regulation. And they're not necessarily wrong, but you'd have the discussion about, you know, we're two rangers, and we are supposed to somehow make sure that every OSHA, you know, safety requirement is taken care of, and every aspect of the park and facilities here. And we're like, if you were to actually do that, you know, we'd be so overwhelmed. Well, when A123 came out, they expected us to do that. The problem is they didn't ramp up numbers of people or money or resources to make that happen. So you still have a full plate that you've been working on, and now you got this monstrous program like structural fire, which is incredibly important at a little park like this with right. all these buildings close together made of wood. It's really important, but it's not that we didn't do anything in structural fire, but you kind of prioritize to what you see and deal with and the time that you have to make it work. Well, when structural fire A123 came out, there you had suddenly these long checklists of pages of things that have to be done, and it became the priority. Some good things happened. I mean, I don't want to say it was awful. We were paying much more attention to our fire safety than we ever used to. We never have had a big fire in the park either way, but we were putting all the time into it and energy. But it means I'm not out there in the park seeing things. I'm not, small violations may just go unresponded to, like we were talking mm-hmm. earlier, altogether. When you get a big case, you suddenly have to have the talk with the management team. All right, this is going to take almost every bit of my time and my ranger's time to deal with this. Do you want me to drop these other collateral duties? You know, I mean, the fee plan that we're supposed to have done and signed in 3 weeks, I'm probably not going to get through it. You know, we got a structural fire inspection coming up, you know. Fortunately, this is a small park with a really good teamwork, and maintenance has been a huge support to us to do that. But nonetheless, everybody's strapped, and we got so much work going on that those collateral duties that are supposed to be less than 20% of your time because of A123 now with these long checklists are becoming 40 to 50% of your time. And when you have five or six of these, it doesn't take a mathematician to figure out that that's a little bit more than 100%. You know? So something's not going to work here. Yeah. So those are the kinds of things that are and the new age and era of accountability have, for small parks, has made it really difficult because the same one or two people get stuck with everything.
Right.
And you got those with aviation safety, with structural fire, wildland fire in the last year and a half has come up and done the same thing. Commercial operation, I mean, all of them are starting to get hit with these requirements. I just had my law enforcement audit, and it's a good audit, and we fared pretty well in the green. But, you know, there's a whole other checklist like that of a lot of things that need to be dealt with here that we just haven't been able to get to. And, mm-hmm. And emergency medical, search and rescue, I mean, they're all getting the same things. And it's like, I've been swamped. How am I going to do more? I mean, right. You know, no one else can step up and do it. So,
right. Well, that's what I was wondering. Sort of, it's the nature of working for the federal government.
Right.
And how you manage all that.
Yeah. Well, I often comment, you know, like the OSHA regs. You know, those were written at a time where you had big industry in the 70s, but you had, you know, all kinds of people working in safety arenas, and there was big industry, but big money, and there was lots of big positions. They probably didn't want to have to staff them all, but the regulations required someone to be able to do all that work. It didn't transfer over to the government very well because we weren't built like that, even right. though everyone thinks of big government. We're not built that way, and unless we're willing to sacrifice entire programs in order to put positions in all these requirements for safety to make sure they're done, you know, which what superintendent wants to do that, you know.
Yeah.
It's really hard. So, and it's just complicated now because we've moved into a realm where just in the last few years, I personally view it this way, and I haven't heard the agency step up a whole lot, but we're in a little bit of a crisis when it comes to law enforcement rangers. I have always struggled to get LE rangers here to Skagway just because we are not a high call volume park, and when you come out of Futsy and you have your new commission and ready to go out and do the job, you want to make your first case, and go into a small park's not going to help you do that necessarily in your first year or 2 years maybe. So that's a challenge, even though it's beautiful. I mean, I fell in love with it, and a lot of people do when they come here, but getting them here and figuring that out sometimes is a little difficult. And we're going through a phase now where so many people have retired that it's such a young workforce that they, it's part of the program's management strategy, but because they're so young, they haven't had their fill of the busy parks yet, so they're not quite ready to say, all right, I'm ready to go to a smaller park now, I've done all that. So we're in a lag, and the recruitment's kind of difficult right now. I'm kind of seeing in this generation, there's not a big desire to do law enforcement. There's a little bit of maybe an edge against law enforcement in this young generation's perspective. So it's getting to be pretty bad. I've struggled to get people here. I've had to find all these unique hiring authorities to bring in good people, and I've done it for about 4 years. I looked to as all my 25 years of being here, I had 4 years with law enforcement that I had good, solid, steady, stable staff with three rangers, even four rangers for a while, and most of those I had to hire somehow other than the mainstream hiring authority. Federal Careers intern program. I'd never used it before. I used it to get Derek Thompson here. He was a great ranger. Had him for 5 years. After I hired him, OPM said we can't use that anymore. I hired Liz Blakely off a SCEP program, but it was the student hired just before SCEP. And after I hired her, they changed it to the SCEP that it is, which is still a good program, but it's just very different. So it was harder to be able to, she was one of my trail rangers, not commissioned for a year, wanted to go into law enforcement, I was able to pick her up. But once SCEP come in that way, it's just a different, the competitiveness, the way it's all managed is different. So you can't target a trail ranger and say, I want to get you into my law enforcement program.
So what's SCEP?
That's the Student Career Employment Program, I think is what it's called. So. Student hire, much like what I went through in college. Mm-hmm. So every time I do something, they do take it away from me. The sad thing is from my perspective, it's successful. But so right now it's really hard. Case in point, we're trying to get a chief ranger here.
Because you're going to retire.
Because I retire in a week here, a little over. And twice we've announced it for several weeks nationwide, and not one expressed interest of somebody to come on detail. All expenses paid to come up here for a few months. We're having to wait for my PD to be reclassified, like most of them are right now, and that takes some time. So they can't announce my position long term until that's been reclassified. So that could be another 3 to 6 months away. So it's just really hard. As I've been hiring. Just seasonal rangers and looking for some law enforcement rangers for vacancies over the last several years. I talked to the big parks, and while they may still have 30 rangers, they're down half, so they usually have 60.
Yeah.
So even though they have a lot of rangers, for their program they're used to running, they're really pressed and strapped too. And when you have that many, anyone who's applying for their first job looks at, ooh, Yellowstone, Yosemite, Grand Canyon, the big mother parks. We all kind of ogled over those when we were young, and that's where they go, and it's kind of hard to pull them away to come up to, where's Skagway?
Yeah.
Southeast Alaska? What does that mean?
You were talking about how you share with your employees some of your little nuggets and your experiences. Mm-hmm. Can you share any of those?
Do I want to share some of this? without incriminating your local people?
Yeah, you can do it without names. Things that have happened that lessons learned on, and
right.
How you've handled things.
Well, there's probably been quite a few of those over the years. We have a lot of locals that are connected in small town with family members, and oftentimes family members will end up out in the park, and whether it's riding an ATV off a trail where they shouldn't be, or crossing through a salmon spawning stream at a time of year they shouldn't be, you have to make contacts with these people, And a lot of rangers, especially right now, they're taught, you know, kind of, this is the response. You write them a ticket, or if it's severe enough, you go ahead and arrest them, or you cuff them and frisk them for weapons or what have you. And that's, you know, and that's not wrong. A lot of parks, that's kind of where they've gotten to be, where if you don't do that, everybody's going to run right over you and damage the resource or steal and consume the resource to a point that it's no longer repairable. But, you know, we're just in Alaska, it's a different cultural experience up here. It's a different level of political scrutiny and just community. And that's what I try to get across to the rangers is, you know, a lot of parks, you have the communities outside the park and people come to you to visit. Well, here the park and the community are so intertwined that it's not, you can't really separate as you're coming to visit us. I mean, we recognize that we are your backyard, and in some cases, literally, we used to once be your backyard.
Right.
You know, so, and we are a community, and we recognize that people, for the most part, aren't going out to intentionally damage the resource once in a while. But for the most part, that's not what's going on. They really just need to learn and know and understand there's a consequence and what that mm-hmm. is. And I've always, whether it was an EMS or SAR, my effort here has been prevention. We want to try to prevent problems because we just don't have the staff and the resources to respond to extensively right. or on a regular basis. So the same for law enforcement, we just don't have the response capability to deal with a lot of crime or big issues. And some of that's how we're built as a proprietary jurisdiction park. We don't have the primary jurisdiction for law enforcement in the area. So I'm trying more and more, and unfortunately our training environment nationally is less and less community policing oriented, mm-hmm. and it's more preparing people for the hard stuff that you're seeing out there.
Right.
That's very real, and it happens every day. Every day I get another email about one or two officers that's been killed on the job, every
yeah.
day,
wow.
and where and how, and that's, you know, adds up pretty quick. And so they have to be ready to do that kind of work, and you don't want to have them come here and you cause them, because of your training and your teaching and coaching and counseling, to lose their officer safety skills,
right.
because that's the worst thing that can happen. But at the same time, you try to teach them that it's not so black and white, that they have to use their heads. They have to think beyond just following the guidebook of do it this way every time in every situation, and think through the big picture. What is the goal of the parks management team with this particular issue?
Mm-hmm.
If it's collecting wildflowers, picking the iris out in Dyea, you know, you know, which is a beautiful, magnificent resource
but
in the park.
But you're not supposed to do that.
It's illegal to pick the flowers off there. But what is the team's attitude about it? Is the park team identified that as that we are the kind of premier? It actually used to be better years ago than it is now. It got too many trees there. But are we the premier site that's preserved for iris growing and viewing? We want to make sure people aren't out there picking it. Then that's something you should be putting your time on. Talk to people, make sure they're not doing it. If we need to write citations, write citations. I don't discourage them from writing citations if they're deserved and they need to be in order to accomplish our goals. But we try to enforce the least amount of enforcement to gain compliance. It's just like use of force, right? You
right.
only use the amount of force necessary to gain compliance. You don't want to exceed that. Well, the same principles can be held true to writing tickets and arresting people. You don't, you know, if you can gain compliance by a warning, why do you need to arrest them? Let's just
right.
warn them, you know? And that's the mentality we try to instill in them, because a lot of places, when they go through their field training, there's no mercy. And
yeah.
it's just like, we're arresting everybody or we're citing everybody. And the family's there at the picnic table with their kids, trying to instill this good park service experience. The kids are picking up pine cones and putting them on the table. And the rangers will come over and give them a $150 fine because they're not supposed to disturb the resource. You know
oh,
I mean?
Right.
You know, that's actual accounts of what I've heard from those rangers
wow.
come back from field training, of what they're told and coached to do. And they get knocked down if they don't
right.
do that. So I don't want that here. We're not going to be a very happy park if the environment, if the community, because I've seen it up and down in this community with the relations, and they will turn against us, and they'll make it very difficult for whatever superintendent and management team here is trying to do anything that
right.
we want to do. So trying to instill into them that mentality of we're community. We're all here living together. We want to live in harmony. We want to protect the resource, but can we teach them and train them in a way that they'll comply and respond without having to totally ruin their day and their experience and their relationship with us down the road? So I don't know if I've given you a specific incident per se, but probably the biggest incidents we've seen over the years are ATVs off trail. And a lot of those are kids, and they're trying to get our goats. Not as much anymore. In the early days, they would do that. We've had a few of them like running their trucks and donuts around the Morehouse lawn because they were mad about us putting a building in front of their view of the Eagles. and that one we took to court, and that was a good case. dogs off leash, lots of people want to run their dogs off leash. We realize it's been a problem. It's getting better, and it's been getting better because we've, instead of just citing everybody and arresting everybody, we've started an education campaign, and we do start putting a little bit more strict rules out there. No zero, no leash, zero tolerance policies for no leash on dogs and things like that. So, and we get out there and we inform people, and we don't recite them the first time. We say, hey, politely tell them, look, you know, this is what happens when dogs are off leash. They've been known to chase wildlife. Even in some encounters, dogs have brought bears back, and the bears have attacked owners. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are all things that, you know, porcupines are abundant in the area. We've had many dogs get porcupine quills in their mouth. So, you know, you try to just educate them and share these experiences. And most people, you know, whether or not they like it or not, they will usually start to comply.
Well, as you said, there have been ups and downs with this community and their response to the Park Service. And is the Rangers and enforcement, you sort of out there, the first face.
We're usually the first. the catalyst for the relations. It is true. And that's why I say it's so important, because you can make 10 years of building relations in the community and have a new Ranger go out there and just with the wrong approach for that individual and the situation set back everything that you've done in a matter of an instant. You know, so it is hard. And it's a lot to ask of Rangers who are just learning, and we're becoming a bit of a developmental park for young, new Rangers getting skills and training. And it's a little bit of an unfair situation for them. But the community is also changing and getting better, too. When I got here, I didn't realize right away. It took a while to figure it out, but just how much the community, and not all, it's just the small majority, how much they had an antagonistic relationship with the Park Service. And you kind of start off already behind the curve trying to build relationships in that situation. It took a lot of years. I was lucky because pretty quick I got into the DARE program, and I started teaching drug abuse resistance education to the kids, fourth and fifth, sixth graders in school. And did that for 10 years and actually moved into the junior high. Never quite got to high school, but we did other things like carnivals for Yuletide and all. So the more we did community-related type of activities, got to know the kids. Those kids now, I'm hiring some of them. They're working on the Chokoo Trail now. It's awesome. And that's the kind of thing, even the parents that maybe didn't used to like us a whole lot sees what we're doing for their kids, and all of a sudden now it's like, oh, maybe it was good they've been here and done these things over the years now, and look how they're helping. So that kind of thing just speaks volumes. But you got to be consistent with it and stay at it. It takes more than looking at this as a stepping stone in my career. I'm going to work here 2 years, and make some cases, and move on to the next park. And that's the kind of thing when communities get a rub against the Park Service for, I can't trust them. You're just here to make a case for yourself, and you don't care about us. That's when it's hard, when there's no relationship between the community and the park.
Do you have a particular case that you worked on that you remember or you most memorable for you?
It's been a few. Actually, the interesting thing is, in 25 years, I've only had a small handful of cases that went to court here. Actually, I had more than 2 years I was in Seward than when I was here. Those were mostly poaching cases, one vandalism case. But, a couple, it's funny, I mean, they're small things, but a couple of them that I wrote were dogs off leash, and these were because the dogs ended up 13 miles up the trail at sheep camp. And it got to the point where I finally had to realize that the owner was really trying hard, but he had a dog that was on a chain. It was about, you know, this big around, an inch in diameter. And he would break the chain and get loose when he was at, the owner was at work during the day, you know. And then he'd latch on to hikers and end up at sheep camp. And one time both dogs ended up there and they were fighting and it was dangerous even to be around them. But those were my first, my first one was an individual in town here who rode through the salmon slough. And it wasn't just they drove through the slough, because everybody drove through the slough in those days. We didn't have the gate there or anything. It wasn't developed. But he did it at a time where there was a bunch of cars parked, so he couldn't get through the slough. And there's an interpreter starting to lead a tour, and there's all these kids and kids in the water. And he kind of looked at the interpreter and grinned at her and drove through the wild iris and around the trees and around the slough, almost hit the kids, and then took off in a real spiteful way. And the police chief just happened to be there when that happened. So I had all these witnesses, statement, and it's like, well, you know, you asked for this one. So that was a citation we wrote that stuck, but it was a particularly interesting landmark case because this individual was known as being the most biggest, meanest, disgruntled individual in town, and it kind of made a statement early on for the others in town. And I was new here; that was my first year here. I had actually helped him get his truck out of the snow once, but that good deed wasn't appreciated. But it made a statement to say we're not fooling around, and we're not going to be pushed around. And he actually wouldn't come back in the park for years after that. He kind of gave certain gestures to me for a while. We had a real problem early on with lack of understanding where the park was out there. And I could understand that because there was no fencing, there were no signs, there wasn't really much of anything out there because they were kind of hands-off waiting for the archaeology to be done before they designed and developed anything. But it was really hard. It was really hard for the staff to know where. When we did those walking tours, everybody, the big joke was nobody did the same tour twice because you didn't know where you were. It was hard for the visitors. And so they didn't, it wasn't always that they didn't want to comply or they were being spiteful. Sometimes they just didn't really know where they were allowed to take their ATV or not. Right. And I began to define my program by making sure we had the proper amount of presence and the proper amount of education with signage and contact and information, but then also facility design. That became kind of the hallmark of my program, was trying to get a balance between enforcement, between education, and designing facilities so that people knew what was expected and could comply, or it deterred those who would put a little effort into violation, but if you designed it well and did it right, they weren't going to put that much effort into it. So I think we had a lot of success with turning that around, and then making a couple of cases like that one really made a statement. We've had some other cases. We did have weapons violation case out in the north end of Dai in the park, and that was one where the rangers heard gunshots. It was people that were drinking and shooting, but they were doing it in a way that was across the river, which we do have raft tours on the river, and then also right, you could see the Chilkoot Trail where people go, 60 yards away, 70 yards away there, and guided tour. That first couple miles of trail, we get several hundred people a day hiking that with guided tours and all, and these people didn't know any about that. They were just shooting, and of course, when the ranger came out there, they heard him or saw him coming, and the guy that had the guns had gone and hidden them, buried them in the ground, and he was a felon, it turned out. Wasn't supposed to be in possession of the guns and all. So they ended up getting cited at night. The next day we went out and found the guns, and there was a case that really didn't go as far as we wanted it to go because we didn't have support locally here to take some of the cases. While the nexus for our involvement was the Chilkoot Trail threat, where they were standing was actually not on federal land, so we didn't have local support to take that case further. So the case didn't go anywhere, but it really brought up a lot on the issue in the community, and we had both sides like, hey, I don't want to be out there with my kids recreating and have people shooting where they're not supposed to be and putting us at risk, and then others wouldn't have gun rights everywhere, wherever they're at, you know? So it was really kind of an interesting, but that's typical of so much of the incidents. It just takes one, I can't hardly think of any contact that was so little that it didn't raise an issue in the community, you know, asking someone to move their car because they're on the plants and not in right. the parking space, you know, it gets talked about in the coffee shop for the next day, you know.
It's life in a small town.
It is. But I often say it, though, because some of the cases that go before Congress have been little contacts like that in the parks in Alaska. You know, some of the biggest ones we're dealing with are the rangers that just want to do a life jacket inspection on a boat, you know, and the guy ended up saying, you can't do this, you can't be here, you don't have authority, and threatening to ram them, and then they pulled guns on him, and then he went to shore, and then they tased them. And
That's the Sturgeon case.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know, yeah.
The Supreme Court, yeah.
So you just don't know in Alaska what little contact is going to end up being before Congress. Yeah. I was working in detail down at Glacier Bay National Park to help with the Tanner Crab patrol, and I was only out 1 or 2 days before I got the flu and couldn't work the rest of the patrol. But you know, we thought it was a pretty nice contact. We probably boarded 12 or 13 boats, and we're letting them know the new legislation that these wilderness waters are now going to be banned next year to crabbing. So we're not here to enforce it this year, we're just passing this out and let you know, but now that you know, we need you to move out of the waters. And while we were there, one individual didn't have their commercial fishing license who was required to, so we wrote a ticket for that. Well, I thought it all went pretty well that day, but next thing you know, we're being taken it's up before Congress, and the Secretary of Interior is being asked to investigate why the Rangers were Murkowski's, Senator Murkowski, not Lisa, but her father at the time, in his words, the gun-toting pirates of Glacier Bay, where they're drawing guns and boarding the boats of fishermen, which we never drew our guns that day. You know, and I didn't even know he'd done the investigation. It was already done by the time I heard about all this. And he's like, you know, everything I'm hearing from the president of the Fishermen's Association out of Ketchikan and everybody representatives, they were courteous and professional. It's just that the owners and the operators didn't like the message, you know. So that's how quickly things get so distorted and blown out of proportion. And anyhow, it's interesting. It's made my career interesting, but it's caused me to be thoughtful in my tactics and approach out there, and I try to pass that on before it becomes major issues for the park.
Yeah. Well, not everybody in law enforcement in Rangers take that approach.
Right. It's easier not to. It really is. It's hard. To do that. I feel it's the right thing to do, but it's hard. It's much easier to arrest somebody because that's black and white. I know the policy for that. I know how to do it. I have the tools. We're set up. Although, I will tell you, arresting somebody in Skagway is not easy. We've got to get them to Juneau, and there's one or two of us, and that's not easy. We don't do many arrests. Yeah. I've done one here, really, and it was when we were assisting the police outside of the park for some operations years ago. But we have policies and procedures set up if we have to, but we really try not to. Yeah. It's got to be pretty serious if we're going to.
Well, and as you see, there's a difference between doing the job you're doing and living here versus coming in as a seasonal, and you don't have to live with the people you're arresting.
It's hard when you go to the gym to work out and there's everybody you work out with you put in jail or something. You know? Yeah, for sure.
I mean, that's the village public safety officer program around Alaska deals with that. Yeah.
Right.
And so it sounds like you figured out a way to have a balance.
I won't say it's perfect, but we try, you know. It's just about being empathetic with people, understanding the situation, and recognizing them as community. And if you treat them like community and not just like one-time visitors who will never be back, which the big parks can often do. They look at these people as like, oh, you've done the wrong thing when you came to the park today. I don't care if you come back or not here, you know. There's a different perspective in how you treat people and just go into these contacts. So, yeah.
So I wanted to ask a little bit about search and rescue, because that's something that you and your ranger team work with.
Yeah. We do. We try to train and be prepared. We don't, again, have a lot of calls for search and rescue. Most of our calls are really medevacs, helicopter medevac maybe, but we don't have to do a lot of searches because we have a pretty narrow valley with steep walls and a trail and a development and staff all along the way. It still happens, but usually not more.
Well, I guess then it's rescue.
10 or 12 hours at a time. So it's kind of more rescue, more EMS response kind of work. We pretty much know where the patient is. It's just getting to them and getting them out. But occasionally we have had a 3-day rescue or a search and rescue one time where we didn't know where the hikers were. But we average about, these days, not many, 1 to 3. We used to average 3 to 5 helicopter evacuations off the trail each year on our side. Now the Canadians have more. And sometimes they do okay, it's rough, and they strain themselves and work hard to get over the top, but then they're in Canada, and they get hurt, or they get sick, or whatever. So they have more than we do, but I always joke, we send them over, and get them to the Canadian side, but it's not really our intent. But, I see a lot of your more minor injuries, but they can't go on, muscle, bone, and joint type of injuries. We will get some illnesses if it looks like it's passing quickly and the next day they can reassess and get moving. That's great. And sometimes we try to do that. Or if it's just a minor sprain, let's see how you feel in the morning, kind of keep them over because we don't want to fly people off unnecessarily. But that is the evacuation method of choice is helicopter, because we've done one litter carry from 7 Mile on the trail, and it took all night long. It was at night, and it was hard. And it's a good maintained trail, but not for litters with 12 people trying to carry a litter off the trail. Man. So we don't want to do that very often. So our recommendation is flying. It just puts everybody at less risk that way. It's a high risk operation, but it's less risk in reality than trying to do a Chilkoot litter carry off, other than the first 2 miles of the trail. And we've had a stroke up there. We've had amazingly, we've not had a heart attack.
We have had
a situation where a guy was on a pacemaker, internal pacemaker plant that stopped working.
Oh.
But it wasn't really a heart attack, but it was enough that they wanted to get him off the trail, and we took him. That was the one that was all night long. We had to get him off. But we've had some falls. We get a lot of, early season with the snow and ice conditions, and especially when it's melting out with boulders down below.
Oh, yeah.
And we've had people, unfortunately, the worst case scenarios where you get sliding on the ice and snow, can't self-arrest, and they end up hitting the rocks at high speed, Had some pretty good head injuries and broken ribs and serious injuries with those, but not too often. But mostly it's more minor muscle, bone, and joint types.
But in the early days when you first started, when it was less controlled up there,
right?
Was it more evacuation injuries?
There were, because, again, especially when we did it at the trail center, there was a lot less. One of the key jobs that's really hard for the trail center staff that I don't think people appreciate from other programs, when they know that they're just in there answering questions and issuing permits and collecting fees, is they're expected to be able to size up the hiker when they come in, just from a few minutes of observing them, talking to them, seeing their gear, and say, is this experienced person or not? How much do I need to change to how I cater my message to them based on a novice, Mount McKinley climber, somewhere in between? And it's a hard thing to do, but they get good at it.
Yeah.
And they've gotten really good at it. And I think, I contribute several things. That, their ability to assess the hiker and give them the right message for preparing. The trail crew right now, this last crew under Eric's supervision when he was out there leading the crew for the last 8 or 9 years now, has gotten the trail tread and maintenance up to such a standard now that anytime there's an accident, the first thing they look at is there's something that is mechanical in the trail that could have, if we do it differently, we could have prevented this. Mm-hmm. And they actually try to fix it. So that's awesome. And then the ranger, we've had good rangers up on the trail who are also assessing and sizing up people and trying to prepare them so their next day up over the pass is going to be successful. And all of that has reduced, I really believe, our rate of incidence of injuries up there. I guess that was what you were asking.
Well, yeah, that back in the 90s when you first started, when there was less control over who was going out there, maybe there were more accidents.
Yeah, it seems like there were. And I mean, there's always still a potential for something to happen, but yeah, definitely they just were less prepared and it seemed to happen more. And we've had a ranger that was out there at that time that spent 3 days with them at the summit, at the pass there, fell and broke a knee on the steps of the building, actually going to get water, and didn't have the pack on. And couldn't get to him because of the weather, whiteout for 3 days. We were about ready to figure out how to gear up to get people in there to manually get them out. and we actually got a window where the helicopter was able to sneak in and get them. But yeah, she was up there with the ranger for 3 days, and that's another challenge, you know, is the weather conditions up there so different. People come in here and they see a day like this, and
beautiful,
they think,
sunny
it's beautiful.
Day.
What do I need to take rain gear with me for? You know, and you get up there and it's a blizzard suddenly, and
yeah.
That's totally not prepared for the conditions, because it's very different. You get not very high, but a few thousand feet makes a difference in this country.
Well, I was going to ask about weather affecting
getting
in there to evacuate people.
Right, right. One of the worst ones we had was a film crew from Quebec who was up at Sheep Camp, and they'd been on the trail a few weeks, and you know, they're trying to recreate the hiker or stampeder experience. Mm-hmm. So they're in period clothing, and they're trying to, it's a little bit of one of these reality competition kind of shows too, and they're trying to recreate the experience with limited food, old gear. And while they're out there, they talk to some of the guides bringing groups over and learn about edible plants and foods that are out there, the berries and stuff. So one of the guys in particular started getting to be a little confident that he could identify food that was good to eat and not when he was out there. So he sees this one plant that's called the false hellebore, and it's a beautiful little bulb plant with kind of lily-looking leaves and something you see in your garden growing. And he's like, well, This must be edible. Just look at it. It's like something in your garden. And he took the bulb of the plant, and there was five of them in the team, and he ended up consuming just the tip of his finger's size of a little finger of bulb, and the others took about the same, but they put it in their mouth and it burnt right away, so they spit it out. Well, he swallowed his, and he got deathly ill. Parks Canada, we actually had, it was our, on Wednesdays, our ranger swap. So both of them were away from Sheep Camp on their way in or out. And the Parks Canada patrol person was coming down to orient with the U.S. side and just happened to be there and was waiting for the Sheep Camp ranger and was in looking at some of the brochures and saw the false hellebore. So when he came across this crew, that this one guy is now just constantly vomiting and just really, really sick. He asked if they'd anything by chance that they'd eaten, and they said, I don't know, and described the plant, and he recognized it from off the brochure. So they called down and said, this is what's going on. False hellebore turns out is the most deadly, poisonous plant in the Northwest that you could possibly consume. So, and it can kill you. And it was marginal weather. We were able to just get in and get him with assistance with the EMT from town. And by the time he got back to the ambulance, the crew working on him thought he was not going to make it. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, they got him to the clinic and got him up to Whitehorse, the hospital, in a couple hours. And he did. In fact, 3 days later, he was well enough to go back out and join the crew again. I don't think he ate any more plants. Didn't recognize. But that's, you know, that's another example of it can get very serious out there real fast. And if the weather's not cooperating, I don't know if he would have made it if we couldn't have gotten a helicopter to him. And it was touch and go. Any worse, I don't think the pilot would have been comfortable getting in there.
Yeah.
So very fortunate situation.
And is it Park Service helicopters? You have your own, or you contract?
We contract with Temsco.
Okay.
Yeah, they got the helicopters on scene here. We could bring in a helicopter from Denali. It would take a bit longer, and they're not always available. But that's probably the only agency helicopter we would try to work with. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, Coast Guard in theory, but they're not always as easy to get as the paper makes it sound in your policy.
Well, and then also, you know, well, you have a clinic here, but if it's some severe incident, you have to get them went to Juneau or Whitehorse.
Yeah. And we do have the Guardian Life Flights
and
Air Northwest, which are great, actual true air medevacs. And Temsco's works medevacs for us, but they're not a true air medevac. Mm-hmm. And that's great because we'll come and transfer to them to get to Juneau in that situation. And they got a full paramedic staff on board and lots of good facilities. But they wouldn't be able to get their helicopter to Sheep Camp. It's just too big. So,
right. Well, but there may be times when you can get them from the trail to town,
mm-hmm.
but then you can't get them to Juneau.
Right. Right.
And then
you hope the highway's open
to go to
Whitehorse. Yeah. Yeah, and it's over the years, it's worked pretty well with the international relations for emergencies like that. There's always talk about whether it can continue, but it seems to have continues. So, yeah, we're pretty fortunate here in Skagway that we have the highway and the boat system and air.
Right.
Airport with the plane opportunity. Mm-hmm. So, hopefully one of those three, and given your season, is going to be open. But we have had short stints where all three are shut down.
Wow.
In the winter, usually.
Yeah. Well, then hopefully a fewer people being injured out on the trail.
Yeah, we don't get a lot of use. And that's another thing that's changed. When I was first here, it wasn't uncommon to have one or two, usually German, solo hikers, or two or three hikers maybe, going over in January or December. And not advised, but, you know, we don't close the trail in the winter. We do discourage use. But a lot of them were successful, though. Mm-hmm. A lot would turn around. And we don't see that anymore, which is good, because it's brutal conditions out
there. Yeah, and is the trail even marked that you can see it through the snow?
Not with what we usually do, if you really know it. But it looks, even I've had rangers go up there in the winter, and they kind of get disoriented, and it gets dangerous, because the whiteout is so white then that you sometimes come up on 30, 40, 50-foot bluffs, and you don't even know you're at the edge of it, you know, and it just all looks like you could just continue on, and that's how you get hurt, turn an ankle, break an ankle, and you die in the minus 40 conditions out there because you can't move. And so it's probably just as well we don't have a lot of winter activity.
You talked about sort of promotion in the within the park, but I know that in like the late 90s, early 2000s, this park kind of went through some reorganization and a lot of people leaving. And do you remember that period?
I remember the period. I'm trying to think of when a lot of people left. It seems like we had people trickle out, you know, a couple here, a couple there maybe. And the one that where a lot of people left was about 2012 or something around there, I think, just before... it was just before Mike Trunnell came in here as superintendent. We had lots. There was one year where we had like 12 for the first time, because we normally keep a lot of retention here for a long time. And all of a sudden, we had about 12 positions that were some high-level chiefs, program leads, IT person. I mean, everybody left at once. And we had a lot of us still sticking around, so we didn't feel like a complete loss of continuity. But it was a major turnover for the first time that I experienced at this park. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, this is very different. Just a lot of new faces coming in key positions.
Do you know why that all happened?
It wasn't like a morale thing. I think everybody's always thought this is a good park to work at for the most part and enjoy their experience. I think it was just that timing. It was probably the first big push agency-wide with retirees going out, it seemed like, in a while. And there was a wave or two of them that went out. And a lot of people's just dream opportunities, or maybe it was just out of convenience, there's a job opening and I've kind of thought about going to this location and all. And just a lot of people took it. It just seemed to be the right time. I will say that what has driven a lot of our people out of here has been the cost of living and housing here. It's really hard for even mid-level management to supervisors to be able to afford to have a house here in town. It's getting hard for upper management. I'm glad I bought when I did back in 1999 and bought my house, because after that everything just skyrocketed, and that's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to see good people come in. It's hard to recruit them, and you get them here and they're great and they want to stay, and you know that they can't afford to live here and leave. I've seen that happen too many times, and that's really tough.
Yeah. Well, I know that this time period I'm talking about, that the regional office sent in a crisis management team.
Crisis management. I think it was
the budget
map,
thing.
Not the map. What was it? It was the superintendent. It was, what do they call it when they bring a team in to review the park because the superintendent's changed over?
No, I don't know. But that's
maybe it was a map team. But anyhow, I think I know when you're talking about, and they were doing a review of the management team and talking to the employees and chiefs, where they had some turnover about maybe what was not done so well, what needed to be done differently.
Yeah, because I think the superintendent, chief of admin, and chief of maintenance all left at the same time.
That was 2000?
I don't know. It was somewhere in the late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah. I don't know exactly. So trying to figure out what...
Because we had one come in when Reed McCluskey left, and... is that when chief of resources left too, and the superintendent, all three of them? Yeah. Can't really remember. I don't remember it as being so much of a crisis, but I do remember there's a couple of times where the management team didn't get along real well, and when a couple of key positions left there, maybe the superintendent probably was the biggest one, that a team, I think they were called a MAP team, came in and talked to everybody to see, you know, what's your idea of the problems and what are your thoughts on how we can do things differently going forward and so forth. So I can't remember exactly which year that was. It seems like that was more recent to me, like around 2010. But
well, do you remember what the problems were and how they were fixed?
Well, a lot of it was personality problems. We had a couple management team members that did not, just real personality conflicts. They did not get along well. They didn't view things the same way at all, different personalities. And all of us at that time got caught up in it in one way or another. There was one personality in particular that was really difficult to work with. And, you know, you're trying to move forward and it felt like out of power struggles was stopping the group from coming to common goals and making progress. So that was probably really the crux of it. We've always had some differences of opinions on how the park should progress, on whether we should keep building bigger or maintain what we have well and not expand. That's been my theory, is we're taking on too many buildings, too many things, and trying to do too much. It's like, let's do what we have well and preserve it long term and sustain it and not thin ourselves out so much that we can't get any of the work done and jeopardize some things that are falling apart because we can't get to it. Not everybody's agreed with me, felt that way, so we've had some disagreements there. But I don't know that I've seen us as a crisis. We had a chief of admin that was a problem for a couple of years and was moved on, and we had chief of resources that was just difficult to work with, and some people felt Reed was difficult to work with. I worked with him the longest probably, and I kind of understood them, and a lot of things we saw eye on, but there's other ways I could see where people had some troubles working with them. But but I don't know that I'd call that was a park-wide crisis. Well, it was just some...
that's Carl's word.
Oh, okay. Well, Carl was under one of those problems for a while. Yeah. So.
I think it was just that there was a big shake-up here at some point. And sort of just wondering how, you know, that affects day-to-day operations and the rest of the staff when all that kind of drama is going on.
There was some of that. I mean, certainly you'd hear from the staff, you know, the one thing they didn't like about working here was having to see the management team set an example of fighting and bickering or yelling at each other. It didn't happen all the time, but it would happen on occasion. Mm-hmm. And when it happened in front of the ranks, then it, you know, that was a morale killer and it didn't look good. And they took that with them, and some of them may not have come back because of it even.
Yeah.
There was some of that.
But you stuck with it.
Oh, yeah.
And why?
I'm just stubborn that way. I did. I mean, I've outlived a lot of, or outstayed a lot of them. But I've been through a lot. When you work in emergency service and law enforcement, drama doesn't really mean a whole lot to you because you kind of already been there and above it usually, and it's just like it's not necessary why you even act in this way. So I don't know. It didn't affect me that much. Obviously, I didn't like it. Obviously, I got frustrated because it's like there's things we could be moving forward and it's taken way too long or not happening at all because, you know, people can't come to agreement and just compromise and let's get something done. So it's frustrating, you know, for sure. But I've also lived 31 years with the government now, so, you know, you have to be patient to last that long in a bureaucratic process. But I've always loved this community, and I love Skagway, and even though the people are sometimes interesting and they battle and all that goes with that in small town politics, I enjoy the community here and the small town life. I come from D.C. area, you know, 30 miles south of D.C., so I'm not sure I would have said that, I want to go live in a small park the rest of my career, but I've come to love it and like it, and I toured enough around the big parks that I found that I like the small parks better just because you can get your hands involved in so many different things. It's not monotony. You don't get so specialized that you do the same thing over and over and over again, which for better or worse, I've just come to like the park here and the community. By and large, we've had a really good staff here over the years. I think that's outweighed the few bad apples or mm-hmm. the difficult personalities that we've had to deal with. And it never got so overburdening that way that we couldn't still get important work done.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you said, that a lot of times for promotion, you have to move on to another part.
Yeah, yeah.
And you chose not to do that.
I never got bored. I always had new challenges, and it seems like there's never the same problem twice until lately. And the problems, this is a big problem for me in these last couple of years, is I've been here long enough to kind of know what the priorities of my program should be, and I can't invest the time into those priorities because I got someone else from outside telling me these are your priorities. And I know that's government, we always have it, but it's just such a smothering rate that it's just gotten to be too much.
So it's this current administration?
I don't think it's even the current administration. It's been happening for two or three administrations now. It's just the nature of the way the government's going. Whether you could say it's because of security, whatever, accountability, ultimately somebody somewhere wants their job to be easier to be know the accountability of what you're doing all the right. time, and are you doing it right? Not now, Steve, unless it's emergency.
We're almost done.
So it just feels like all of the government workers out there are going to work harder, unreasonably so, to make sure that we have an easy way of being holding everybody accountable right. for everything that you're doing, and we know that you're doing it right. That's what's gotten to be so hard. And I can understand it if there's like rampant corruption all through the agency. And I just don't see that. There's cases, I mean, the most worst ones are military usually. But, there's always going to be cases, but it's that same old strategy of punish everybody because a few people here screwed up,
right.
And we're going to make sure that we capture the person who screwed up and everybody else too.
Right.
So it's just the process. It's being smothered by process. That's become the priority over everything else, and it's just, I don't feel that's right. But it's made it hard to really do the job I feel like we're supposed to be out there
yeah.
doing. So,
well, I heard a criticism from somebody in the community about the Park Service, and I don't know if it applies now or if it was mm-hmm. back when they first came, but the Rangers walking down the street in the historic district with guns on their sides.
Yeah. Funny how they do that.
And so you do that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're law enforcement officers, and you can't really do your job if you're not prepared when something happens.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's very different. When I got here, I was told, don't wear your gun on the job in town. When you go to DAE, maybe.
Right.
But, don't wear it out in the community. And eventually we had a couple of Rangers killed elsewhere, and parks policy started saying, you're going to have rifles, you're going to have patrol cars, you're
mm-hmm.
You're going to have vests, you're going to go out, and we're asking you to have to respond. We want to give you the PPE to do your
right.
job, and we're going to train you and do it right. And so the community didn't necessarily catch on at the same rate that the early Rangers had to step up with policy. But I'm sure you will still hear that from time to time. But we're law enforcement, federal law enforcement Rangers are, a lot of people still don't want to even recognize that you have
yeah.
police powers, but we do.
Yeah, I'm sure if you're a shop owner, during the summer season and you've got
mm-hmm.
lots of tourists and then there's a Ranger with a gun, it probably has a different look.
It can, depending on your background and perspective. A lot of people coming off the ships, they want to know law enforcement's around. Everything I've studied in security and tourism is, they don't want to come into a town where they think they're going to become a victim of a terrorist attack because the town's not ready to deal with protecting it. And so they're actually finding, don't send an army out into the street more than the number of visitors that are there, but make a presence to let them know that it's a secure town and that someone's there to step up and help if things go bad. So I still have mixed opinions out there, but we're not, like I said, I'm not in the business of making my Rangers less safe or the public, but just being smart about how they approach people. You don't, just because you wear a gun doesn't mean you have to go out and act like RoboCop.
Right.
You have to be cognizant of it, but and that's where the challenge comes is. You've got, sometimes if you don't hire the right Ranger, they come in and I had a Ranger one time where after the Fourth of July parade, you know, kind of late in the day, and he's walking down Broadway. It looks like an old West town where he's just kind of, I own this town, you know, and it's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, that doesn't help with community relations.
No. But that's kind of a rare thing. But yeah, you know, there's going to be those comments, and I find that those comments is they just don't really understand the world outside that they live in. And you know, we are kind of a little protected here. It's kind of nice. You know, I go to Haynes and I'll go to places, and you know, they can't leave their door unlocked because someone will come in and take their food and or steal stuff from the facility. And they have serious problems down there all the time. And, well, you know, we have our issues here, especially with domestic. But we're a pretty safe town. I mean, we got an international border just out the road. Yeah. You got to get out by plane or boat. You don't get very far. People, at the end of the season, when they're tempted to steal money because it's their last chance, they got their last paycheck, you know, for the winter, and they steal from their business owner. Usually they get as far as Haynes, maybe Juneau, and the troopers meet them, or the police meet them, and that's about as far as they get, you know. So anyone who actually thinks through their action doesn't really try to break the law here too much in a significant way in Skagway. So we're pretty fortunate that way.
But, well, it sounds like you've enjoyed your career here.
It's been a great career. I don't have any regrets. I feel like I've received this career calling at a very young age and pursued it. The doors open all the way through for me, everything I really wanted to do. And it's gotten me to what I ever wanted to achieve. I think when I was here as a GS-9 park ranger, I was like, well, now what? I've achieved my career goal. But it's been really good. And the last 2 years have been hard, but I don't regret it. And the timing's just right for me to move on now from a number of arenas. But,
So would you say the most challenging has been these last few years with this policy?
Last 2 years, because of the situation with trying to run a law enforcement program and the whole recruitment challenges, but then the A123 compliance requirements and just the scope and workload that has come with that without additional support or flexibility to... recognize that our shorthanded situation here in the ranger ranks. But I won't just pin it all on that. Some of it is a leadership directive. You have different leadership styles, and some want to see lots of things accomplished that aren't necessarily core to our day-to-day base operations. And whenever you have that, the day-to-day core operations suffer. And it's not that I love doing all the core stuff that's required with the safety inspections and so forth, but you can't do those and bend over backwards to make sure all these highly politically viewed projects and accomplishments are getting completed at the same time. And that's where I think for about 6 years we were out of balance there with what we could reasonably expect to do and what we were being expected to do park-wide with just big projects. Mm-hmm. Centennial, in 2016, gave us a lot of money. And I've learned a long time ago that money is not necessarily your best friend. You need enough, but when they throw a bunch of money at you, there's going to be a bunch of work coming at you. And when the money comes in the last 2 months of your period to spend it, and you have to somehow get the work done, it doesn't work very well. Right. And everybody's stressed. It starts threatening people's safety and well-being. They're out there doing things in a hurry and not able to, they start to lose situational awareness, and you start to risk, you know, getting people injured. And it's just all of it. It just all compiles, and it becomes not a well-managed program. And I felt like for a couple of years with all the money, all the projects, all the push, get it all done, and on top of what I was already struggling with, that was just too much and insurmountable for me. I mean, we survived it, but it's not without cost.
But it does sound like who is superintendent makes a difference. It's their leadership and decision-making that affects everybody else.
Yeah, it's their responsibility to be tuned in enough with the well-being of their staff and what's going on to say, okay, we're at our limit, let's step back and let's accomplish these three priorities. And not just like, well, I expect to see what your breaking point is. We're going to get as much done as we can until I really feel like you're about to snap. And That's one thing if you're in a military strategy situation where it's fighting for your life. It's another thing when we're trying to sustain a program. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
Well, I really appreciate you taking so much time today, especially in your last week.
Well, thank you. Well,
I don't know if there's anything else that you had in mind that you want to talk about when we set this up.
I think we covered a fair amount. I'm sure there's a lot more that I haven't touched on in 25 years. But I think you're able to draw quite a bit of my experience here out today, and I appreciate the opportunity. It really has been a wonderful place to work and wonderful people to work with. That's what I'm going to miss the most, are the wonderful people here. We really are. One thing I've watched over the years, and I just see it time and time again, is new people come in from other parks, and they're just like, this is such a wonderful place. And you, when you've worked here as long as I have, you kind of lose sight a little bit of what's going on at some other parks there, the problems and the challenges they're having, and whatever we've talked about here pales in comparison to some of the other issues out there in a lot of parks. So we really are blessed with the people that we've had here and to work with, and we've got a lot done because of it and the teamwork, and we've come a long way in the community with our relationships. Yeah. And all of the superintendents in the recent years have been a big part of mending the relationship in the community. Mm-hmm. They've all been public outreach, working together, compromising where you can, holding firm where you need to for resource protection, and they've been fair, and I think that's helped a lot.
Yeah. So some of the earlier superintendents were not so conscious of that.
It's hard. I don't want to pin it all on them because I was sometimes in the same boat with them. It's just hard when people have a chip on their shoulder toward the federal government, and that overrides everything else. So no matter what you do, you're always going to be the antagonist and the problem. But Clay Alderson, the early superintendent, they loved him when he came here. He was here to come in and build the golf courses and the tennis courts and put in the swimming pool. And then all of a sudden, a few years went by, and they're like, you didn't do all those things. Like, well, that's not what the national parks are about. So I don't know what happened. When you read the administrative history, you know, you get an idea that, well, there some things were said. Some of it may had some truth. Some of it's probably just distorted in the community's eyes of what they wanted to hear and didn't hear it. But anyhow, whatever happened, the expectations of the community in a lot of cases didn't add up to what the park actually brought in here. Yeah, it built up these beautiful buildings, it brought in some economy and some business people, but you know, it kind of ruined their backyard. You know, they can't just go hunt and run their ATVs everywhere like they used to. So, and then there are some other matters, that personal matters between the railroad, which is the big powerhouse in town, and the park, which is a new power coming in, and tourism in general, that's this whole new powerhouse coming in, and all the top people became kind of adversaries. So Clay, you know, quickly was caught up into something he probably couldn't control very well, and he and the White Pass president, I know when I got here for the last 2 or 3 years before that, Marvin Taylor, before he passed on.
He was still president when you got here?
He was president when I got here. His son later would step up into the position. But he and Clay were very staunch adversaries for those last couple of years. And there was a whole thing with the oil spill into the park in the Forest Service area from the railroad, and some park people, and Clay included, were involved in investigating and seizing evidence from that and getting with EPA and FBI and other agencies. So that became a really nasty case that some people went to jail over with White Pass. Other people lost their jobs, and everybody got pulled into court to testify. So even though the Park Service wasn't the primary investigating or prosecuting agency in that, just the fact that we were involved and supported environmental protection and all that, that was really the biggest wedge, I think, that was driven between the community.
So what was that oil spill? What happened?
I think it was a pipe. It wasn't really a spill that happened. It was a pipeline break and a spill, and maybe at the same time it seemed like there was some illegal burning or unpermitted burning up on the tracks. And what happened is the FBI came to investigate, and some individuals lied or tried to cover it up.
So it was a line that was through White Pass's owned the
White Pass owned the right of way and had the line, and the fuel that was coming down I don't remember if it was specifically for railroad operations or it was actually for the community, but it was just one of their lines they kept and maintained. But the big problem was is that they cleaned it up or tried to clean up, cover it up, and then they lied and tried to cover it up further, and some people got in trouble for that, and the whole agency. When you get prosecuted as a corporation like that, the whole corporation becomes a felon. So it had long-lasting implications for them, probably to this day. But anyhow, yeah, that there's a big employer in town, White Pass, for many, many hundred years, more or less. So that was hard to overcome. It's taken 20 years for new faces to come in, old faces to go, and some memories to be lost to heal over some of that. So, yeah, it's been a lot to overcome in the community here. So, you know, yeah, so Clay was, you know, that's his typical, praised early on, and kind of pushed out in by the end, and everyone that came in after that was kind of gauged a step higher just because it wasn't Clay. But, you know, they had to prove themselves, and some did better than others. But,
and now, was Bruce Noble before Clay?
No.
Although he was after.
Yeah, he's probably 2-3 superintendents after Clay.
Who was before Clay? Who did Clay replace?
I never knew him. I do remember when I got here, I'd recognize the name. Was it Jarvis?
Or Sims? Or Jarvis?
Sims might have been the first one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think Sims was the first one. I feel like there was a Jarvis that came in after him. But I didn't know them. Yeah, okay. But they were liked. I mean, I think they
were. So when you started, Clay was the superintendent?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Jake Cable had been chief ranger before Bruce Reed. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard when we had a Bruce Reed followed by a Reed McCluskey. Right.
But I remember Jay's name.
Yeah, Jay Cable. He was a regional safety officer for a lot of years. Because he was, it's kind of funny because he'd tell the tales that he'd get up and he'd try to be at a public meeting and talk. And he remembered one instance where they threw tomatoes at him. Oh. You know, so that was his experience. His challenge was he had to come in and he was the first chief ranger, I think, with to really enforce the regulations of the park, and everybody was used to all this freedom out there. Right. So he had a tough time, but he had a good personality. He had a big family, and he was integrated into the community quite well. But it was still hard for him, I think. Yeah. So anyhow, I appreciate the opportunity, and you know, I know we have a lot of good up-and-comers working here. I look forward to what they're going to do with the park and steward it behind me. So.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.